Welcome to this episode of the Comedy Defect Podcast. My name is Winter, I'm a comedian, and this is my show. Those that are new to the show, welcome. Those that are old to the show, thanks for coming back, guys. Now, this is a podcast where I talk to comedians about how they do their stuff. You know, what's the secret behind the laughter? You know, their history, what they're up to, what they're going to be doing. And you know what, right? This one, you're in for an absolute treat. I saw this comedian when I did my first Edinburgh run in 2013. And what he does is like nothing I've ever seen before. And it's sort of beautiful. It's human. It's connected. It's its own thing. And it's not manufactured. It's different every time. And I can't describe to you what it really is without you going to see it. And this episode, I spent an hour or so speaking to the excellent Trevor Locke. He is such a great comedian. But I don't know, he kind of does something else. His stand-up is excellent. It's different every time. And that's what can happen sometimes. You know, if you do a set, it's going to be slightly different every time with different audiences and responded to differently. But what he does is completely turns stand-up on its head. It's not emceeing. It's a different animal. As I say, I don't want to ruin this conversation, but you'll hear what we're talking about. He runs workshops for comedy as well. He runs comedian workshops. A joke hospital he runs online. He also does this thing called reality games, where you join his WhatsApp group and he gives you tasks for the week to do, and then they meet up and discuss what they did in the week. And it's just a really nice way to stay connected. He's an excellent comedian. And you will not be disappointed. There's some absolutely great bits of information in here and some inspiring stuff for comedians and people who want to be comedians as well. So I hope you enjoy that, right? You can find him online, and it's Trevor Locke. He's on all the socials as Trevor Locke. That's T-R-E-V-O-R and it's L-O-C-K-E. So you can find him there on all the socials. And if you want to follow me, I'm on Instagram at Winter Dominus. That's WINTERDOMINUS. My name is Winter Fonander. You can find me all around the place. And if you want to go to Facebook and like the Comedy Defect podcast page and also join the Comedy Defect podcast group, I just post the podcast and also gig dates that I've got coming up. As I say, I'm not gigging an awful lot. I'm just doing my gigs at the moment because I can't walk. I'm learning to walk again and it's slow going. So, you know, if you want to book me, I'll have to have car share of some kind. But yeah, so that's what's happening now. And if you like this podcast enough and you want to buy me a coffee, and you can, but if you don't want to, that's fine. Just share your favorite episode with your friends because it tells people where we are and what we're up to. But if you don't want to do it, I understand. There's so much noise out there. Don't worry about it. Don't forget about it. Just, you know, do something else. Go enjoy your life. I don't want to force you to do all the things you got to do. There's loads of things you got to do, like taxes and look after the kids and work and, you know, some loads of stuff you don't want to have to do. Just, I don't want to be another chore for you got to do. Look, if you want to do it, do it. If you don't. It's all right. But look, this is an excellent episode with an amazing sort of comedian. It's something else, really. A comedian, Trevor Locke. Enjoy. Trevor Locke, thank you for spending the next hour or so of your time with me on the Comedy Defect.
How long?
An hour, depending on how it goes, you know. So how are you getting on?
Fine, absolutely fine. Lovely, yeah, really good. Just having my second coffee of the day.
Right.
Yeah, all good.
Is that the ritual in the morning? Do you just like...
There are no rituals really, but no, it has to, yeah, the coffee has to happen at some point. No. Yeah, I'm not very good without coffee.
What's your poison then? Are you like full strength or like just, you know, in between?
I just love fannying around. So uh-huh. Yeah, I've now decided that I can't have too much caffeine. So I make a blend. I grind beans and then I mix it with the most expensive decaffeinated coffee I can afford so that I can have two cups of coffee a day. Yeah. Sometimes three rather than just one.
Just trying to wean yourself off it a little bit. Just I have like lots of tea and I have a little pot and I just have like bags and bags of tea, and I know that I'm getting addicted again to tea because I keep having to keep refilling it, and I'm like, and my wife's like, will you stop
we just stopped drinking tea so much. I was like, look, it's the only thing I can do at the moment. So I like the fact you've got a whole system that prevents you drinking it more. So you grind the beans, you put decaffeinated, the most expensive one, into it as well. Because there's also a budgetary constraint with that as well. I like that. That's good. That kind of slows you down a lot.
Yeah, I just like doing things, really, like mucking around and making things slightly more complicated than is necessary. It gives me a modicum of pleasure, you know. And then at some point I'll get bored of that and I'll just go mainlining on the normal coffee, giving myself the jitters and panic attacks and stuff. Yeah. It's not safe to have a panic attack yet, but once the restrictions are lifted and it's safe to have panic attacks in public again, I'll be back on the full strength.
There's always hope. What's the thing that kind of that's the thing that kickstarts you into just inertia, I guess, at the moment, is it?
Yeah, whatever has to happen, you know. I never know what's going to happen. People often ask me, what are you doing today? What are you doing tomorrow? And I rarely know. So I was able to answer, but people asked me yesterday, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said I was going to be doing your podcast. And then what do I do tomorrow? On Wednesday, I do online workshops, for want of a better term. I meet up with people online, and sometimes I meet up with comedians and we go over their jokes, and sometimes I meet up with normal people and we don't talk about jokes, we just talk about things they've seen in their walks. So I'm going to be doing that, one of those tomorrow. I'm going to be talking with comedians and talking with regular people.
Where can you do that? Is that just like a private thing that people come contact you separately?
I whack it up on the social media and then it sort of spreads a little bit by word of mouth.
I mean, I first saw you at a gig in, I think it was near Tottenham Court Road, underneath a pub, and it was a full room, was rowdy as hell, and you were closing and you were singing to the audience at the end.
Really?
Like, do you remember that? Like, no.
I mean, you need to give me more.
It was a wonderful gig. It was when I first started. Like, this is maybe eight, nine years ago.
Where was the gig?
I think it was in Tottenham Court Road. That's where it was.
Gig underneath a pub in Tottenham Court Road.
Yeah.
I don't often sing on stage.
It was run by Charlie Harrison.
Oh, I know the one. Yeah. So it was actually the top of Charing Cross Road.
Sorry, yeah. Charing Cross Road. Right. It was a lovely gig. And they were quite rowdy by the time you got on. And it was a club upstairs, I think. And people kept coming down through the comedy to the toilet. But it was a lovely room.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a nice room. I don't remember singing. Yes. What did I sing?
I think you were trying to get them all to sing with you with the song. Come on, you know the song.
Okay. Okay. It was a joke then.
Yeah, it was a fun thing. I also came to see you at Edinburgh in 2017 in the show. I can't remember. I don't know the name of it. And it was one when
probably Community Circle. Yeah.
Yes, that's the one. That's the one. It was great fun. Loved it.
I was just saying I was going to make a disparaging remark about my output.
Yeah.
I was going to say that's the only show I've been doing for the last 5 years, but it's not true. Actually, I've done that. I realise I've forgotten about some other shows that I've done, but I mainly do Community Circle.
You have shows when you remember, but I came twice to that show, and I don't know if you remember this one, because you know you have ones that stay in your head. There was a guy in there, you were asking someone their name, and somebody in the room said, "Don't tell him, Pike."
Oh, I remember that. Yes.
That was it.
It was fantastic. That was a fantastic moment because it was in the context of... I had to explain that joke because there were some French people.
That's right.
In the room. And there were some foreigners in the room, weren't there? And
that's
I had
right.
to explain Dad's Army to some Germans and some French. I really remember that. It's very funny. Yeah.
Yeah, you're explaining like what an open spot was, and then you're like to these French ladies, like an open spot, a grenouille. It was great. It was so great.
I love the Edinburgh Festival, obviously. And one of many reasons I love the Edinburgh Festival is I get a multinational audience. Not so much now. I've moved to, well, I don't know where we are now, but yeah. But in Bannerman's, I get a multinational audience for some reason. There's so much fun to be had.
Yeah,
you know, when you don't have jokes, when it doesn't matter, when you don't have carefully written material that obviously can only be understood with a minimal level of understanding of English, when you don't have to worry about that, a multinational audience is just heaven for someone like me.
It's proof of concept as well. It can work anywhere, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yes, it's an absolute pleasure. When I go to a place and I know that there's going to be a mixed lingual audience, I'm always excited. Yeah, I love it.
You've been in Edinburgh shows for how many years now?
Oh, since the 90s.
Right.
Yeah.
And like you've gigged with, you know, one of my favourite comedians, Andrew Maxwell.
Yes. Yeah,
excellent.
Yes. Yeah, and we used to have the same management. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You did the Fringe, and was it called the One Show? Was it the
number one show? Yeah. Show with him. Yeah. That was a terrible show. Absolutely awful. Yeah. We fell out. Me and Andrew argued terribly.
Oh right.
It was me, Andrew, and Daniel Kitson. Me and Daniel Kitson were beginners. We weren't very good, and Andrew was very good, and his agent at the time wouldn't let him do an hour show. He was sort of holding him back so that he could win the Perrier. And Andrew wanted to do his own show, and could easily have done his own show, and so instead he was hobbled with me and Daniel Kitson. It was just awful.
Yeah.
It was like a football team that doesn't work. Yeah. They would try to put us in different positions. So first of all, it would be, let's have Andrew. Can Andrew MC the gig and headline the gig? can Daniel open and Trevor go? And now, what about if Daniel MCs and Trevor? We just did all these different configurations.
Yeah.
And it was just basically trying to find a way of not ruining the show for Andrew and the audience.
Yeah. That's
great. There was really very little evidence that Daniel Kitson would go on to be Daniel Kitson.
Right.
During that show anyway. It was very strange.
I know this, you're most of yourself is improvised now. Were you improvised at the beginning as well?
No. I didn't improvise. I did a different thing. It was similar to improvising. It was not learning your jokes very well. So I would have to improvise, but I would sort of hobble myself by starting jokes and then not knowing them well enough. And they just sort of peter out into desperate. I mean, I was not a comedian then, really.
Right.
I occasionally I could be funny.
Yeah.
But I had, my confidence was absolutely shot in that show. So I went on stage every night, and they reduced my time. So I started out, I was the opening act, and I started out doing 20 minutes. Yeah. And by the end, I was down to a middle eight.
Oh.
How can you be the
middle
act? Yeah, it was awful. Middle eight, that belongs in a song, not in a comedy show.
Wow.
In which your name features. Yeah, it was an amazing experience, actually. You realise how much is confidence, really.
Yeah.
So I was lucky that year because I'd written a play. The play was really fun to do.
What was that called?
It's called Friday Night at the End of the World. And that was just fun. We got lucky with the reviews. But this stand-up thing was just terrible. It was just knowing every night. I just knew, oh God, it's going to be awful tonight. You know, how bad will it be? And there was no indication there that I could ever return to a comedy club. Total and utter failure. Daniel made it work. By the end, Daniel was emceeing it, and it kind of worked. But for me, that was just crushing, humiliating defeat night after night for
a
month.
How did you transplant some self-esteem from Edinburgh back to your continuing of your comedy career?
Well, I sort of gave up, I think. I gave up being a stand-up.
Oh, right.
After that, I had a good run with the Edinburgh play, the play that I'd written, and I sold it, actually. To be turned into a TV show. So it went into development. I got some money, and it seemed that's where my success would come from.
Great.
Sort of abandoned comedy, just started writing scripts and trying to sell scripts
yeah.
and do stuff like that. And so that's what I did for the next few years.
So for since 1999, you were like, you did that for the next few years.
Yeah, because that, you know, there's no rhyme or reason to things, really. Mm. I wasn't a very good playwright, I don't think. Yeah, I mean, I was young, you know, so I was, how can you be good at anything? So I was just learning. But that worked. People would buy things from me. Sometimes things were made into radio plays, but nothing was ever made on TV or film or anything. But I would get treatments and the options would be sold, and people were interested in backing me to go to the Edinburgh Festival with a play. Couldn't go. You know, the idea of me doing stand up wasn't even broached.
Yeah.
So the idea of me doing stand up at the Edinburgh Festival was never taken seriously.
Right.
But I could lose thousands of pounds of other people's money on a play.
For less audience, I guess, really. The place get full.
Not really. I mean, they would sell out on the weekends.
Right.
Because people couldn't get to see anything else. Very few people wanted to come and see my plays. So about 20 people would come to see them Monday to Friday, which, looking back, is brilliant. And then at the weekend, with Friday and Saturday and Sunday, would stand the chance of being full because people couldn't go to see what they wanted to see.
Excuse me.
And I just got lucky with reviews as well. I think because there wasn't anything else like what I was doing, really. Mm. Apart from, obviously, you know, there's real plays, and then there was Richard Herring doing his stuff. But there was there wasn't a sort of amateur playwright doing funny plays.
What was the play, the first one that you got reviewed on, based on?
Friday Night at the End of the World was about, it's awful to think about it. Sort of a mixture of, because people were worried. It was 1999, so people were worried about the millennium bug.
Right.
Yeah, remember that?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, so people were worried about the millennium bug. Have you noticed how people are always worried about something? the sky's always about to fall in, I've realised now. Anyway, the bit of the sky that was going to fall in 1999 was the numbers. The numbers were going to go mad. And, planes were going to fall out of the sky.
Yeah.
And, steam would come out of our telephone.
Yeah, that's right. Computers would explode.
So I wrote a play about, I don't know what it would be. It's just people, and it had magical bits, flights of fantasy in it, and bits of. It's all right. It was okay.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no plot to it. There was no drama, really. But for some reason, we had a really nice, it was a very nice venue. It was a very nice, so we could do it in sort of stage it in three different stages by accident. I think it's where Cabaret Voltaire is now. But it looked completely different back then. So the audience would sit in rows and then, but the play would take place in three different parts of this room. Sometimes they'd have to skew round in their seats to look at different bits. So it was a nice atmospheric staging. There was I had a couple of funny speeches, had a really funny sex scene. I remember there was a sex scene.
Yeah.
So we're having sex, and then leave my body. I have an out of body experience, and I leave my body, and I look down, and I'm watching myself having sex. So I think that was quite fun for people to watch. It was nice. It was a weird little thing that somehow worked. Nice spirit to it. I think it had a nice sort of spirit to it.
What time was that in the day? Because you had the number one show in the evening, and you have
this was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh right, okay, cool. Yeah. Right. So that was your palate cleanser before you did the misery in the evening, is it?
Well, yeah. So I'd get up, walk in, do that show. I was staying with Ross Noble and Marcus Brigstock in the New Town, so it was a sort of a long 30-minute walk into town to do the show, the play, and that was always fun. Although the audiences weren't massive, so sometimes we were playing to very small numbers, but the show was always fun to do. And then a sort of long walk back, and then I had to summon up the courage to go back in again for the stand-up show. It was a really schizophrenic sort of
very lonely
experience because Marcus and Ross were they were mainly, you know, doing their shows, their big hit shows in the evening, and then in the day they'd either be, you know, in bed or doing, you know, a bit of media, a bit of TV, whatever. Yeah,
really tough experience, I'm sure. Was that the first one you did, that first Edinburgh?
That wasn't my first Edinburgh festival, no.
No, when was your first one then, please?
Well, I went up with, so there's a very successful theatre director called Erica Wyman, and I think she's ever so important now. She's a big, important figure. If you knew about theatre, you'd know her. But back in, I don't know, the early 90s, she was not. She was doing a PhD at UCL. It was lucky enough to be to find out that she'd written a play. She was an adaptation of Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse, and she took that up as part of the University College London thing to go to the Edinburgh Festival. So I was in that.
Nice.
That was my first taste of the Edinburgh Fringe
experience. First taste of being into debt.
Well, no, because it's all
paid.
You know, you have to. I think we had to put in a couple of hundred quid.
That's all right.
Because it was all subsidised by the UCL Drama Society.
Oh, excellent!
So it cost us. I mean, it was a lot of money for me, but it was like going. That's cheaper than going on holiday, you know.
Yeah. So that's right. When did you like decide to do stand up then?
I don't know. It's impossible to say.
I didn't know. Yeah.
So that year, when I went up, Erica Wyman took me like a little boy, like a lovely auntie. She took me to see Scott Capurro.
Oh yeah.
Because I'd never seen stand up, and then she thought I was funny.
Yeah.
And so she took me to see Scott Capurro because he'd won one of the Perrier Awards. I think he'd won the Best Newcomer Award. And she got us in to see that show. And I'd never seen stand-up before, but I'd got an idea of what it was, you know. And his show, I really enjoyed his show because he had a sort of, he flipped between, it was slightly, he had a nice theatrical device where he was talking to the audience in some bits, and then he'd snap his fingers and there'd be a tight spotlight on him and he'd be doing stand up, sort of in quotation marks, which I thought was quite cool. And so that I found that inspiring. I wasn't really interested. I don't know. I had no exposure to stand up, and I just liked theatre.
Yeah.
And I liked the possibilities of, it was, you know, I'm a lazy writer. And I like performing. So it was writing for myself or writing for a person on stage seemed like that suited me. You know, it was sort of had the immediacy.
Yeah, with control.
Yeah, exactly.
What was your first joke you ever wrote? If you remember it.
Oh, I don't. No, I don't. I don't.
Do you remember the second one?
I can remember. So what I used to do, I found it really hard to write jokes.
Yeah.
And so I can remember. So one of my, I used to do sort of rubbish. I couldn't do jokes. So what I had when I started was confidence.
Yeah.
So I had the confidence to not care that I didn't have jokes.
Yeah.
And I had the confidence to just talk rubbish. And I sort of did what you might call, you know, fake jokes or anti-jokes.
Yeah.
So I remember I used to talk about, they'd have the rhythm and the structure of jokes, but they wouldn't be jokes. So I'd say things like, oh, I went to the shop today and I bought some pies, but they were frozen. So when I dropped them, they shattered. And that was a joke for me.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And people, audiences, some people would laugh, but I'm not sure why they laughed. I think they might have laughed because there was no punchline. It was delivered as if there was a punchline. Or
great.
I delivered it with a sort of panache. So when I dropped the pies, they shattered. And, you know, I don't know, but people would sometimes laugh. So yeah, I did that. That's that kind of stuff.
Cool.
Or I would, you know, I'd say, oh, here's a thing you can try. Here's a thing you can try. You can just go, ah, it's a delicate sound. So what you need to do is you just need to, you know, let the sound come out, and it's from the bottom of your throat, and you just go, ah, and you can try that anywhere.
Yeah.
At home. Imagine you're at home and you can just go, ah. So they were, it was sort of absurdist stuff.
Yeah.
Nonsense. And I had the confidence not to realize that I was ruining a lot of people's comedy nights. But that's how I started.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and you can understand. I don't think I was doing that in the number one show.
No.
But nothing too dissimilar, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Somebody must have thought I was good enough to go to the Edinburgh Festival.
When I see you on stage, you always seem like you're in complete control, but there's a wit that will venture off onto a surreal plane. Like, when you were younger, were you sarcastic? Like, did you have like that sarcastic kind of like, well, just, you know...
I don't think I'm sarcastic.
No. Okay.
No. I'm not a very funny person. I miss jokes. I don't get jokes.
Right. Okay.
I'm not very quick at getting jokes, let alone writing them. I've got better. You know, I enjoy writing jokes as a sort of hobby.
Yeah.
Even though I rarely do shows or do jokes in my stand-up.
Yeah.
These days,
yeah,
I still write jokes because I enjoy it. It's fun, and I do a thing called Joke Hospital online, where I sort of script edit other comedians. So I enjoy it, and I can do it, but it was never something that came naturally to me.
Yeah,
what came naturally to me was being witty,
yeah,
and being funny in the spur of the moment, and that wasn't something that I was able to understand or recreate to order on the stage.
Yeah.
You know, I struggled when I started to be on stage and be funny because I tried to make it up as I went along.
Yeah.
And I found that really difficult. I didn't need, you know, it was a shock. When I saw some people doing the same jokes twice, that was a shock. They weren't just being funny spontaneous, and it sort of made me relax and realize, oh yeah, well then I can try to
do the same thing,
remember some things that worked once and try them again.
When you did the first gig, where was that?
Weirdly, my first technically my first stand when I first tried to do stand-up was at the Bloomsbury Theatre, because I was at UCL, so you know,
it's a big gig.
It wasn't a big gig. It was just the, you know, the students doing a charity night.
Nice.
But my first open mic gig was a guy called Noel Kelly ran a night somewhere in South Kensington. So I did an open mic night there. That was my first one. My first paid gig, I'm very proud to say.
Yeah.
Malcolm Hardy gave me my first paid gig. So I did Up the Creek on a Wednesday night and was talking nonsense. I remember it very clearly. It was in my time when I didn't know how to write jokes but I was sort of trying to do jokes. I wasn't, wasn't trying to improvise. I'd learned not to just try and improvise.
Yeah.
But I had these silly jokes about pies shattering, teaching people how to make sounds or doing walks. I would do funny walks.
Yeah.
And anyway, I tricked the audience at Up the Creek into laughing at me. Malcolm gave me a paid slot, you know, 6 months later. And I hadn't worked very hard, hadn't learnt very much, and went for my paid 10-minute slot. And I think it was on a Saturday night. And I just had the same rubbish, you know, that I could get lucky with, you know.
Mm.
And I didn't get lucky with it. The audience saw straight through me. Oh. This guy's bullshitting. And I remember Matt Welcombe said to me afterwards, he said, yeah, I mean, you've got the look. Because I used to wear a snow leopard skin, right. A snow leopard fur coat.
Yeah.
But this big lady's snow leopard fur coat.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, you got the look. I like the look. You've got, but you know, it's not just about the look. You really need to have some lines.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Yeah. You're dressing for the job that you want.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a fantastic death. It was really good. I really, you know, I got started getting the shouts of Malcolm.
Oh no,
Malcolm! And then he came on afterwards, and he said, "Well, there you go. I told you, might be good, might be shit, but it was shit. There you go."
Oh, yeah. So, what's your worst gig you've ever had, then, Trevor?
It's impossible to say. I can't remember. I've had so many worst gigs.
Right.
I suppose the worst ones are the more recent failures, just because I'm a more experienced comedian now, and I'm relatively speaking, I know a little bit more what I'm doing, or at least I know what's expected. So that makes, you know, when there's a failure these days, it's much more, I feel it much more perhaps because I know what's expected. It's more avoidable perhaps.
You've more self-awareness now of what can be done, I guess, as well.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm lucky at the moment, I suppose. I just did a gig a couple of years ago in Singapore, but it wasn't terrible. It was just like, it was one of those ones where it just wasn't, this is not my room. And it was fine. The gig was probably fine. It just wasn't, you know, I was headlining a stand-up night.
Yeah.
And I didn't do a headliner's job. And you feel that. You just think, well, you know, I shouldn't have been booked for this gig, and I didn't do it as well as other comics would do. I did it to the best of my ability. You know, if I can't see the audience, for example, it's really, really hard for me. It's really, really difficult if the lights are so bright that I can't see the audience.
Yeah.
Because I don't have jokes. I'm just talking. I'm improvising. And that's really difficult for me. So I feel those sorts of things more painfully now than I do a terrible death where you're being escorted from the stage, or they're booing you or throwing things at you, or afterwards, you know, you get bumped into roughly by people at the bar. I've had things thrown. Here's the things that have happened to me. People have escorted me from the stage. I've had things thrown at me on the stage. I've goaded the whole audience at the Banana Cabaret into booing me off stage, refusing to leave until everyone is booing me off stage.
I think that's in your beginning of your career, right? That's in the very beginning of your career, must be.
Yeah.
And but like, yeah.
Yeah.
So like, but in fairness, that's getting them all to boo you off stage. At least they formed a complete group. You did that you've united all of those people, no matter what, again, towards comedy, not necessarily your comedy, but the next act.
Yeah. I mean, I just, you know, I look back on what I did when I first tried to do stand-up with a mixture of sort of awe and shame, because it is great. I love to see an act that is free and you don't know what's going to happen next. So I do admire that in an act. But also I had no idea what I was putting the promoter through. It didn't occur to me. I was completely ignorant of the dynamics and the expectations of a professional comedy night. It did not occur to me that what happens before you might affect your spot, and what you do might affect the person after you. That was something I hadn't learned. Simply hadn't learned yet. Hadn't occurred to me. I was behaving very badly. I was a liability on any comedy night. I can imagine people dreaded seeing my name if they knew who I was. There were clubs that never booked me again, and quite rightly so, because I just, it was ignorant, and I got an agent far too early. Somebody saw me get lucky and assumed that I was better than I was. That can happen. You can see a comedian twice, and they're very funny, and you draw an over optimistic conclusion, and that's what happened. And I was sent out on professional bills to do 20 minutes on a professional bill, and I simply didn't know what to do. I hadn't seen enough comedy, let alone done enough comedy. I didn't know what the expectations were. Yeah, embarrassing to think of things of what I did on stage.
Yeah.
If you discount that, I think that kind of innocence and freedom is what I love in an act, actually. That's what I want. I want to see somebody who I don't know where they're going to go next, what they're going to do.
Like Tony Law, like yourself, right. you have that now,
exactly,
as well.
Exactly.
You have the same sort of, when I first was beginning, I wanted to give them every single bit of energy I had because I thought that's what they needed. You go up there and because I was full of confidence, had no skill whatsoever, entered things way too early and just threw myself at everything and went fully all out on everything I did. But it's just, it wasn't funny enough, you know, there wasn't even a joke in there. I just thought it was a story with energy, you know what I mean? It'll be fine.
Yeah.
And it's not the same thing. And you just kind of try not let the whole thing experience shape you into this thing that you're not, you know what I mean? You want to just continue to be yourself in that same joy of performing rather than a cookie cutter experience from stand-up, which is really become the case.
Well, I've got nothing, you know, it depends what you want. It depends what you're trying to do. You know, I think it's absolutely good and right that, you know, comedians have jokes and say them in the right order and remember all the words. That's good. Some of my favourite comedians are completely different to me. Obviously, I admire people who write brilliant jokes.
Who's your favourite comedian then, Trevor?
I don't have one because there's just so many brilliant ones. How can you possibly pick one at the moment? Mm. You know, at this moment in time, they're just kind of every comedian I see becomes my favourite because there's just so many brilliant ones. The cookie cutter comedians, I love them as well. I love people that write jokes and deliver them brilliantly. Can't really, Alistair Green, Luke McQueen, Paul Foot, Javier Costales.
Oh, it's brilliant.
But just, there's so many.
If I ask a question, everyone who comes on the podcast, if there was a job or it could be an animal, it could be a job or just like a mythical being, when you do your stand-up, is there anything that you could model yourself on at the beginning or now? Maybe at the beginning and now, say with the comparison, if you could.
Yeah, well, there is a squid that has no brain and just a massive eye. I've never seen this squid, but it exists apparently, and it's just a big eye swimming through the ocean. The sort of shows I do most recently, live shows, I think there's an element of that, in that I am just... I'm like a massive eye. I'm just seeing stuff. I want to hold everything. I want everything to be, whatever can happen, to happen. Whatever. Increasingly, people come to my shows. We're not talking about doing a stand-up night. When they come to my shows, there's a sort of open-mindedness that's we don't know what's going to happen, and there's a sort of absence of a brain. I've got no, I don't care what happens. I just want to be there for it, if you know what I mean. To let it happen, let whatever's happen. So that's where I am now. When I started out, it was the mythical beast. When I started out, it was like taking drugs to be on stage. It was like... felt like I was communing or trying to commune with the audience, but in a much more focused way, in the opposite way to how I do it now.
Yeah.
I wanted people to sort of ride this crazy, mad hose pipe that's splashing water all over the place.
Yeah.
You don't know where it's going to go, and that's it. But We'll ride it together. Is that a mythical beast?
No, I know what you're saying.
A naughty hose pipe splashing water everywhere. What a rock and roll image.
Yeah.
I'm like a naughty hose pipe splashing water everywhere. Get out of my way or get wet.
I think, just out of control, right? That's but you just want everyone to join the party. Come on, let's go mad. Yeah, let's go crazy.
Yeah exactly. But now... there's nothing like that at all. I don't care now, you know, because I've come around the opposite way now. It's sort of, it doesn't matter what happens. It's going to be all right. Usually it's going to be great. But the way that it will be great is by not caring.
Yeah, that's it.
In the best possible way. I want everyone to have a great time and to think, wow, that was an evening well spent or an afternoon well spent. I care in that sense, but I don't care how that happens. So I was manipulating when I started doing stand-up, and then as I got sort of better at it, what I learned to do was better manipulate the audience to know how to get them to make that noise. That was what I became good at. I was a master manipulator of audiences into making that noise. Yeah. Okay,
that's great.
And that was ultimately tremendously unsatisfying. You know, I basically, I just became a teacher, didn't I? It's just like, I can say some things and they'll make that noise.
Yeah.
Every night, say these things and they make that noise. That's right. Sometimes they don't make it quite as much as the last night, but basically that's it. And I hated myself by the end of it. That's how I stopped, you know, I couldn't bear to do it. And that's how I came to what I do now.
Yeah.
Is because I abandoned the manipulation. And now it's just like, okay, now my skill, my task, if you like, now my task is to accept whatever happens, whatever happens out of my mouth or whatever it is, brain, if I have one, you know, my eye without a brain, to accept whatever happens out of the other people, whatever happens in the room, to accept that and basically facilitate it. It will happen. It happens on its own. That's what that's what happens now.
Yes.
The comedy, the laughter, the show happens on its own.
Yeah.
And all I can do, in the negative sense, I can get in the way of it. In the positive sense, I can just move the chairs out of the way and give it some room.
I love it. What was your favourite show then you wrote? Is it The Community?
I didn't write it, you know, and I didn't even come up with it. It just happened. It just happened. All I did there was I abandoned the show that I wrote.
Yeah.
I wrote a show.
Yeah.
I was dreading saying the words that make them make that noise so much
Great. That
I would waffle on with a preamble setting up the show until I only had 15 minutes left of my hour. And I just thought, well, just stop it. Just do another 15 more minutes and you're clean. You leave the stage clean. You don't have that tension in your stomach. So I just said to people at the beginning, right, you've come to see this show. We're not going to do that show. I'm sorry. There's going to be no jokes. In fact, there will be no prepared content.
Yeah.
I bet the show will be funny. You'll have a lot of fun, but there's nothing written. Okay. Yeah. If you want to go, that's fine. It's a free show anyway. You can just leave without putting any money in the bucket.
Brilliant.
And that's how it started. Yeah. And that's how it is now. And you know, even people, I don't need to say that now. People know what it is. People can feel what it is.
It's such an honest show in a way, you know. It's just like, look,
exactly.
It is what it is. I'm not fooling you. You are the show and I am the show and we are all in this together and no matter what happens. So it gets by, it becomes, that's what it's called, isn't it? Was it Community?
It's got a shit name. It's just called Community. So it doesn't, you know.
What's it called?
Community Circle.
Community Circle. But it's great. Look, when I was in that show, I came twice. There were people in there the first time I got there who'd been there three times, you know? And like, they were like, oh, we're going to go to this because it's different every time. And you get returning audiences coming back again and again. That is brilliant.
That's right. Because then that's exactly it. That's the thing, you know.
And it can only get better because, you know, the audience have practiced.
That's right. That's exactly right. That is exactly right.
It's brilliant.
So,
they get better at heckling, and then, you know, you respond. You said, "No, look, you said that last time." You know, it's wonderful. It's like it's like, oh, that's such a warm environment to enjoy your stand up in. You know, in your comedy, in the comedy. It's not even. It's just connection.
It's not stand up.
It's connection, isn't it?
It's got nothing to do with stand up. Mm. You know, because there's no jokes.
Yeah.
There's no point. It's more like
humor.
It's more like sometimes, you know, sometimes in I moved it to Summer Hall. I think my Daniel Kitson actually does shows there.
Yeah.
But it's not really a comedy venue. So most of the shows were funny.
Yeah.
But some of the shows were just sort of like, I don't know, it was like a meditation class.
Yeah.
we sat there in silence and hardly said anything. Right. And there was this sort of just, it was, and people loved it.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Wonderful.
Some of the people had never seen that show before. That's what they think. That's what they think Community Circle is. And a couple of times, you know, there's people who've been to other ones before, and yeah, it's great for them.
Yeah.
Because they're like, oh my God, I've seen it twice or three times now. Yeah. This time that happened, this time that. And this time, no one spoke. And we just sat there looking into each other's eyes.
Yeah.
And it was, there was this sort of, it's like a, I don't know. I've never been to a Quaker meeting, but like I imagine a Quaker meeting might be. So it and that's why it's thrilling for me to do.
Yeah.
Because I can't predict really what's going to happen. It's usually going to be a lot of fun and a lot of laughter. It's usually going to be a lot of laughter, but sometimes it's just like this sort of weird connecting sort of
cult.
Yeah, like a satsang, like when you go to a meeting with a. I go to non-duality meetings. It's a bit like that sometimes.
What's a non-duality meet? Sorry,
it's where you just sort of go and listen to somebody talking about non-duality.
What's that?
You just sit there.
What's non-duality?
Non-duality is a way of seeing life that can't really be put into words. So
okay,
when you go to a non-duality talk, there's often not a lot of talking because you can't talk about it, and so you sort of sit there with your eyes open usually, but you can do it with your eyes closed.
Okay.
And there's a sort of nothing is happening, but it's really cool that nothing's happening. In fact, a Dutch couple came to the one in Summer Hall last, or whatever we did Edinburgh last. They said to me afterwards, they said, oh yeah, so this is non-duality. Ah, okay.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay. Like, so really, none of those gigs can go badly because you accept everything that happens,
yeah,
and just
right.
And
that's
ride
right.
It. It's not even good or bad. It's just
it can't go badly. No, they can only go really, really well.
Yeah,
or extremely differently.
Yeah,
and they can go badly for individuals
in
the audience. I've seen that in Ireland. We did one in, is it Longford?
Right,
and there was one person. It was quite a small show. We're all in a circle. We're literally in a circle. So it looks like a 12-step meeting for some kind of recovery program. And one person, fair enough. They come to see a comedy show and they're sitting in a circle and I'm reading out people's thoughts from the circle. It was troubling for them.
Oh.
I think they felt like they'd been scammed.
Witchcraft. You're how are you reading my mind and my who I am?
Just
my physicality. Wow, interesting.
But I'm sure they had an amazing experience. Actually, I mean, it wasn't what they wanted, and they complained about it during the show. But the way that that sort of complaint is heard and held within the group, and the way the group deal with it, it sort of that person isn't rejected. They're not mocked. It inspires laughter. It's extremely funny. That everyone is having this wonderful experience, but one person just doesn't get it and thinks thinks that they're the little boy seeing the Emperor's New Clothes and is so frustrated that everybody else can't see it.
Yeah.
That is enormously amusing to everybody else.
Yeah.
And yet that person isn't sort of mocked, rejected, or kicked out. There's some kind of, they're still us.
Yeah,
they're still with us.
Yeah,
and so there's a it's a very warm feeling.
That's great.
So afterwards, there's a feeling of warmth. You get a feeling in your solar plexus.
Mm. Because they will get it eventually. They will finally click. Because it's not about.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe they will or maybe they won't. But it's. Yeah, and it's not, you know, obviously that's not the experience I want. That's the, the I want people to be rolling around in tears of laughter. It doesn't matter what I want. That's the point. It doesn't matter what I want.
That's true. That's it. That's a wonderful evolution of your act from the trying to control everything, finding that you you could control everything with these manipulating phrases and like words, and you just was like, I'm bored of this, and this is just doing my head in. And then you went to just like, right, okay, when you, even with that stuff, that beginning stuff, I get, I bet there was times when it all worked and it was all perfect, but in it being perfect, it's just, it's terrible because it's not perfect, because it can be better than that. And then you go and do your community circle, and it's like, it's that, even in that moment when it was perfect and there was that joy and that rush, and you could feel the audience being one organism, you know, you could like, this could go further than this, I could push them further and it could be much more connected. They could just, rather being a hollow experience, but now the community circle, it's all connected and they are one organism, but a one organism that has free will.
Yeah, it's like the one is like cocaine,
yeah,
and the other one is like MDMA. So the other one, it was all about the coke rush, the yeah. buzz, the rush, mm-hmm. this, you know, flight of fancy of this joke, the rush of saying something funny about that person. It was cokey, you know, yeah. cocaine, yeah. And now it's a mellower
yeah.
connection. It's love, yeah. you know.
I'm going to use a terrible analogy now. It's like you're the blanket in the middle that makes them feel comforted and warm.
Well, I'm not there, you see. All I have to do, you know, it's not... It's, what I love about it is that I don't have to do very much, really. Right. Just don't ruin it. It's great, because the funniest lines, you know, if we're talking about things that people laugh at, lines, language that people laugh at, the funniest lines in my shows are usually written by people in the audience.
Yeah.
So all I have to do is speak them out loud in
yeah.
a clear voice. That's my job.
That's great. That's great.
I'm just the host serving them their own food.
That's great. What have you brought today?
It's better though, isn't it? You've got, you know, I mean, how many people come to see my shows? About 50 people. So you've got 50 people's sense of humour, whereas before it would be one person's sense of humour.
Yeah.
Now, or 51 people, we've got 51 people's sense of humour to entertain us all.
Yeah.
It's just obviously going to be better.
Exactly. That's great. What have you got coming up then? You're still writing plays at the moment. You've got the comedy. Is it the Joke Hospital?
So I do at the moment, it's down to two Joke Hospitals a week. And then I do a thing called Reality Games. That's the new thing that I'm doing, where I set people little tasks to do every day or during their week. There's a group doing it, you know. So at the moment, there's some people. Someone's in Poland, someone's in Germany, and then there's the rest of us are in London. And I set little daily tasks and weekly tasks, and we do them, and then meet up once a week, and people sort of present experiences, their findings, and we share what we've noticed from doing these things.
Like what for example, what tasks would you be setting people?
This week they had to fall in love with a tree.
Right.
They have to go for a walk without purpose and this, and whatever they hear, they have to hear it as if they don't know what it is. So if they hear birds singing, they have to sort of somehow not know that that's a bird singing and hear it as if they don't know what it is they're hearing. Sometimes they have to write letters or photograph. So they're every day they have to send in a photograph at a particular moment of the day all together.
It's great.
From wherever they are around the world.
That's wonderful.
So they all get a snapshot. It's like we're all one brain, but with many eyes.
That's great.
From all around the world. And then the particular point that we've agreed on, these pictures return to the brain, which is a WhatsApp group.
That's great.
I started it in November. I publicised it on social media, but also what's nice is word of mouth has spread it a little bit as well. And people seem to enjoy it. It's really lovely.
Yeah.
And I enjoy doing it. I enjoy meeting up with them once a week and hearing how... Because these are all... They're all sort of things that I've done over the last 7 years, things that I do. And I think if you're creative, they can be inspiring. But yeah. I think if you're just a person, they can just be really nice ways of experiencing reality. So it's fun for me. It's really fun for me when people really get a particular thing and don't come back with stuff that's it's kind of inspired them.
Yeah.
It's really lovely to see.
That exercise is like a real experiencing the world as a child again, like you've never seen anything, which is a, I was thinking about that the other day, being in a home in Ireland, just going through like the nature, and just you found a stick and it was fine, you know. Oh, there's a better stick there, I kind of like that. Was I don't know why I prefer this stick better to this one. That sort of daydreaming in the world, in reality, it should be done more often. It's wonderful. It's all like, it sounds like you're, even outside of the comedy, you're connecting with people, which is what it is all about in the end, in multiple ways, in the correct way. It's like, it's a very, you know, it's a quite wholesome pursuit that you're doing with your comedy.
I don't know if it's a wholesome pursuit.
I mean, it's always an agenda, of course, but you know what I'm saying? There's like...
Well, there is a science, you know, it's pay attention. That's basically it. Just notice. That's all it is. Just notice. Mm. That's it. So when I'm on stage, the way my shows can work, the way I can do a stand-up night without having any jokes, the only way probably that I can do it is I have to pay attention. I have to notice what I'm listening to, what I'm hearing, notice what I'm seeing. If I am paying attention to what I'm seeing or to what I'm hearing, then that's more than enough to be able to do 20 minutes of performance. But that's true. I'm not paying attention, if I'm paying attention to me, if I'm paying attention to my interior monologue, if I'm paying attention to some joke that I've thought up and prepared, then the chances start to lower. The chances start to diminish because I'm just not paying attention to human beings, to what's happening here now in front of me. That's applicable to everything, every moment of our lives.
Yeah.
There's always enough. And there's only never enough when we're paying attention to a line of script in our head, rather than what our senses are reporting to us.
That's true. That's wonderful advice for comedy and, as you say, and for life. Wonderful. So you've got, I say, the Joke Hospital come once a week now?
Yeah, I do. So we do Wednesdays 12:40 to 2:40 and Thursdays 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock. And then the reality games is when I get enough new people together, then we pick a time to do that.
All right.
So if any of your listeners want to participate, just shoot us a message on Facebook.
It sounds like something I'd like to participate in, to be honest.
Yes, well, it's great. I really enjoy it.
Well, Trevor, it's been a pleasure to talk to you for the last hour or so. And have you got anything, apart from all the stuff you're doing as well, is the community circle... Is that coming up soon, or are you booking that in the future or anytime soon?
I don't know. I got a very encouraging message from Tokyo this morning about the possibility of bringing it there in November.
Yeah.
I don't know what the Edinburgh Festival is doing. I haven't heard anything back from that. But it might. I got an encouraging email from Summer Hall at the beginning of the year. So there may be... maybe some kind of skeleton festival happening in August there. I'll find me online. I'll do one online.
It works on Zoom as well?
Yeah, it does, weirdly.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. And what's your handles and everything online?
Find me on Instagram at the Trevorlock, and on Facebook, Trevorlock1, and on, what else do you want to find me on? At the Trevorlock.
Brilliant. Well, Trevor, thank you so much for spending the last hour or so with me. It's been a pleasure to chat to you.
I'm very flattered to be asked.
And that was episode 111 with the comedian, the tamer of the beast, Trevor Locke. Oh, it's just wonderful to spend an hour or so with that guy. He's brilliant. As I say, he doesn't do comedy like anyone I know, and it's just connected. It's a thing on its own. It isn't comparable to anything that I have seen before, and it's just an experience every time. It's completely different. It's like improv, but it's not like improv. It's more connected than that. It's like people are the parts of the show, and they really become the show, and it's wonderful to watch. You got to go see it. I can't really describe it to you. It's unique. And he runs joke hospitals for comedians online. And he also runs a thing called reality games, where you join a WhatsApp group and he gives you tasks for the week. And you come back after the week and you discuss what you did. Again, staying connected with people. And it's because that's what it's about. That's what life is, isn't it? Being connected with people. That's why people do comedy. You know, they want to be connected with people, but they forget that when they do the jokes, they just go back in their head. As I say, there's some real nuggets of information about comedy to stay connected, and some real great little tips. One of my favorite tips that listening to this podcast back, he said, you know, when referring to comedy, there's only never enough comedy when we are paying attention to a line of script in our heads. It's perfect. That's exactly right. You got to just be there in the moment. And that's how you should live your life, really, I guess, as much as you can in the moment, you know, and just be connected with the people that are around you and be, you know, a human being rather than just, it's not an act. It's, you know, more human than comic. Because I'm not going to lie to you, some of the comedians out there are just not human beings. They're not good in human. They're not good human beings. You know, there's a lot of people that aren't great human beings or comics. But he is doing the opposite. He's being a better human being through comedy, which is staying connected with the people in the show. It's really, really an interesting social experiment. I say it's called Community Circle. If you ever see it in Edinburgh, go and check it out. He does it every year. Go and see it. You will not be disappointed. You can see it again and again. It's different every time. Some great things. So yeah, Trevor Locke for 111, right? You can find him on all the socials as Trevor Locke. TrevorLocke. Trevor Locke. And you can find me on all the socials as Winter Dominus. That's WinterDominus. Or you can find me under Winter Phonander as well. I'm there. I run gigs in Hertfordshire, and I will be gigging around there. And you can go to Facebook, like the Comedy Defect Podcast page, and you can also join the Comedy Defect Podcast group as well. I'll post gig dates, I'll post the podcast up there. Nothing too crazy, nothing too annoying. I just social media, you know. But you find me on Instagram if you want to follow me and all the updates and stuff. And I've got my show coming up as well, which is about breaking my legs. Some great jokes in there. So I hope you keep updated on the upcoming previews that's going to be happening this year. I don't know if I'm going to take it to Edinburgh this year, but because of my injury, because I can't walk yet. So we'll see what happens. And next month, we've got another fantastic comedian. Sister from another mother. Half Sri Lankan. It is, of course, Stella Graham. And that is for the last Wednesday of April. Until then, enjoy yourself. Take it easy. Get on with your stuff. Don't go mad. Take it a bit at a time. See you in April.